Welcome to the Next Level Human Podcast. As a human, you have a job to do. In fact, you have four jobs: to earn and manage money, to attain and maintain health and fitness, to build and sustain personal relationships, to find meaning and make a difference. None of these jobs are taught in school, and that is what this podcast is designed to do: to educate us all on living our most fulfilled lives through the mastery of these four jobs. I'm your host, Dr. Jade Tita, and I believe we are here living this life for three reasons and three reasons only: to learn, to teach, and to love. In this podcast, I will be learning, teaching, and loving right along with you. I'm grateful to have your company. Here's to our next level. Welcome to the show, everybody. Welcome to the Next Level Human Podcast. My guest today is someone I think I'm going to have a really interesting conversation. We're meeting for the very first time. This is Danielle Massey. She is an expert in something that I really am excited for you, the listener, to hear about. And this is shadow work. And that is actually the title of her latest book. It's a book I haven't had a chance to get yet, but my girlfriend is reading it and just loving it, Danielle. And I also, one of the other things about Danielle you'll hear about that I love is that, you know, on Next Level Human, one of the things that I love the most is to get people who are, you know, teaching their expertise, but also people who have been through their own hero's journey. And so Danielle has certainly been through some of the more difficult and scary things that we humans face. And she is coming out of that and teaching from this place of passing on her understanding and her expertise to all of you. So Danielle Massey, welcome to the show. I'm really excited you are here. And let me just start with the kind of question. Give us a little bit of an idea of your journey, how you got here, the work you do, and a little bit about some of the things that you've been into. And then we can kind of get into a discussion about shadow work.
Absolutely. Yeah, my journey was kind of weird and winding. I started off my career as a licensed psychotherapist in traditional private practice. So I was seeing, you know, 40 clients a week, working about 80 hours a week between that and being a professor at Penn State University teaching child development in the brain and a course on abnormal psychology. And I was really burnt out. I did that for a long time. I've got two young kids also. So between dropping them off at daycare, running over to teach, running to my office, seeing clients till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, it's no surprise that I ended up getting diagnosed with cancer. And at the time, it was shocking for me. I didn't see it coming. My doctors were really surprised. But from all the research that I've done now and all the things I've looked into, stress is the number one cause of all illnesses, whether it's cancer, autoimmune, or even just the stuff that we deal with on a regular basis, like depression and anxiety. So my stress levels were so high, and I knew that I had to take a step back and create some real change. I had to do something different. For me, it really came down to figuring out what would get to the root cause of my issues. How could we actually get to the base reason why my life looked the way that it did and why I was coping in the ways that I was or triggered in the ways that I was? And that was how I found shadow work. I found this woman in the UK named Allison. She was a licensed psychotherapist just like me, but she'd quit and put all of her energy into doing shadow work with people because she found that it just hit on a deeper level. And I was hooked. I was so deep in it. I did shadow work with her for a couple of years, and she taught me how to do it with my patients in my private practice until eventually I moved away from being a psychotherapist. And now I teach shadow work internationally at different conferences. I'll speak on it. I have my books like Shadow Work that just came out this past fall. I host a conference called Selfish Philly in Philadelphia that's all about self-care, with shadow work kind of as the basis of why I do it. But we bring in all different types of practitioners, doctors, nurses, mediums, like literally everything you can think of. And really, for me, it's about just creating this ripple effect of change, because I didn't realize how important managing my stress levels were until it was too late.
Yeah, and here's the theme again that comes up again and again, which is why I love talking to people like you, people who have suffered, confronted sort of their dark night of the soul, kind of took a deep look, and I want to go a little bit, if you don't mind, into what this was like for you.
Of course.
And began to change the trajectory of their lives. And oftentimes it follows this path that they grow themselves, they then begin to enrich others, and they then begin to create things to reach the masses. Like one of the things that I oftentimes say is that we are here, in my opinion, for three reasons and three reasons only, and that is to learn and to teach and to love, and that our suffering and our wounds are the mirror by which we can see and understand what we might be learning, what we might be teaching, and how we might be loving. And by the way, love I use is sort of a phrase that really means more create for others without the need for acknowledgement, reciprocation, and reward. And so one of the things I'm most interested in when I hear stories like yours is, if you can bring us back into, you know, sort of the pain, the shock, the fear around this diagnosis, and how you began to look at, so you alluded to it, right? That there was something there, that stress and, you know, perhaps suffering in some way, there was something there that you began to look at. And I'm interested in what exactly that was. How did you start to discover what may have been the underlying contributing factor or cause of what was going on with you?
Yeah, I'll never know for certain exactly what it was. I'll never be able to pinpoint it because science really hasn't been able to get there yet. But I have my own ideas about why this was able to develop in my body. When I started shadow work, I kept going back to early moments in my life, moments where I experienced things that completely altered the trajectory of the way that my brain sees the world. Our brains are as unique as fingerprints. We all see the world so differently from one another, and that lens impacts the choices that we make. It's why some people have a much easier time being successful and other people have a much harder time. And the early part of my life had a lot. I mean, that's an understatement. It had like an exorbitant amount of trauma and stress in the early years. And it only got worse as I got into middle school and high school. Some of the things that I experienced were things like sexual abuse from multiple people. I had some childhood trauma. I never really felt comfortable where I was because we moved around a lot. My mom was a drug addict when I was young. My dad almost left because of it. We were really poor, bouncing from borough to borough around New York City. And I just stuffed all that stuff away somewhere. I just hid it from myself so that by the time that I got to college, I became a machine. I was just focused on getting to the next thing, the next level. So I buried myself in school. I became really enamored with the brain and how it works, which is why I studied cognitive neuroscience. And I just tunnel visioned on helping other people. And it's funny, you were just mentioning love as this idea of doing things without reward, with no gain, just doing it for other people. But I don't think there's any such thing as altruism without something that you're getting in return, because you're always getting something back, even if it's a little bit of energy or that feeling of accomplishment, feeling really good about yourself for doing something for other people. That reciprocity that comes from those moments was what kept me going. But it wasn't something that helped me manage my stress. It was just something that kept me from burning out completely. And it wasn't until I had cancer that I actually looked at this stuff and went, holy crap, what did I do? How did I let myself get this bad?
Wow, I love that. And actually, let's talk about that love thing just for a minute, because I actually agree with you 100% on that. One of the things that, it might seem contradictory here, but one of the things that I think about when I think about the idea of love is that there's two ways to get acknowledgement, reciprocation, and reward, right? One way of doing that is to look for it for others, sort of this very culture way, and to do the things you do so that others will see you in a particular way. The other way is to authentically sort of show up and do your work. And in a roundabout way, I agree with you, because in the end, nothing is truly selfless, but there's something very different about doing something because you love it and being able to accept the love that comes back to you versus, and this is me asking a question, because I love whenever there's slight differences in the way we see things. So the way I would see that is that, and I want to see if you agree or disagree with this, is that if I'm doing something, this work that you began to do, if I'm doing it because I want people to accept me, love me, keep me safe, keep me secure, which, by the way, all of us humans want. But if that's the main goal versus I'm doing this because it is, I feel it in my authentic nature, something that I must do. Do you see a distinction and a difference there, or is there no distinction and difference there?
Oh, no, absolutely a distinction between the two. And I'm so glad that you brought this up, because this really goes back to attachment and the way that we connect to other human beings. I mentioned before that I used to teach at Penn State, and one of the things that I would teach in that child development class in the brain was about attachment. And in the first few years of our life, we learn how people are going to show their love and how we're going to receive that love, which is where we really generate so much of our identity. And for the people who feel like they need more, like they weren't given enough by those primary caregivers, they tend to be the earlier version of what you said, where it's really about me. I do this because I need to receive. I do this because I need to feel my cup getting filled up. Versus the people who have secure attachment, who are doing it because their cup is so full, they feel so connected to human beings that they actually have a little bit to unload. They have something to give. So the reciprocity is still there, but the motivating factor can be wildly different. And I find a lot, because I, in my world, everything that I do between doing the books and doing the international speaking tours and whatnot, I come across a lot of people who would fall into the first category, where they're really doing it for themselves because they love the feeling of being recognized for their work. They love the feeling of having applause at the end of what they do. And it's not really for the people that they're out there helping. And they may still be helping a great amount, but the motivation is so vastly different.
Yeah, Danielle, this is so, so interesting to me. If you don't mind, let's unpack this just a little bit more, because one of the things that I have found, and sometimes it sounds like I'm making a statement, but this is really a question for you. So forgive me if it comes across as a statement. It's really just a question. But one of the things I have certainly seen in my work, and what's interesting is I have certainly begun to do a lot of, the work that I think many people are called shadow work. I don't necessarily refer to it as that, but I really like the terminology. And one of the things that I have found is that when you are coming at it from this culture level perspective, and what I mean by that is that your major drive, and of course, there's no judgment here because we humans, this is just what we do as humans. We all want safety, security, acceptance, belonging. And so we have different strategies. And so we show up and we are in this position where we go, okay, I'm going to do the thing and I want to be acknowledged, reciprocated, and rewarded for that. Now, of course, that's normal. However, when you come at it from that perspective, there's something, I don't even know what we might call it. There's a, let's call it a form of neediness that oftentimes people pick up on that, and it can become somewhat off-putting. And then some people start figuring out along the way that I will just do this and I will fill myself up just because I can. And in a roundabout way, they end up getting the acknowledgement, the reciprocation, and the reward from the people that they were trying so hard to get it from. And it's this subtle sort of shift. So I love what you're saying, that we humans, we must have these things. We shouldn't have judgment around it. But do you see the same thing? And can you talk a little bit about this culture level, look at me, pay attention to me, I'm going to do this to get rewarded, versus this more what I would call next level purpose oriented thing, that you end up getting exactly what you were seeking, but it comes in sort of this roundabout way. It's not completely selfless. You end up getting it anyway, but in a much, in sort of a counterintuitive way.
Yeah, I think it definitely depends on your lens. But for me, I think so much in terms of the experiences that we have throughout our childhood, because a lot of shadow work does fall into that category. And with attachment, we have three types. We have the secure attachment, where we know that we can trust the people around us. We know that our parental figures kind of set us up for success on that front. They were there when we needed them. They gave us the support. They put us to sleep, changed our diapers, all that good stuff, and followed through the whole way. And then we have the two other types. We have the anxious person who really feels like they're not sure if they're going to get that stuff. It's always kind of a toss-up. Are they going to be there? Are they not going to be there? Is my support person going to take care of me? And so they have very nervous energy, and it's always about needing something. Mm-hmm. I need something from this other person. And then the last one's avoidant. And the avoidant person goes, I don't need anybody. And that's really just a defense mechanism because they've closed themselves off in such a way. But in reality, they need people the most out of any of the three groups. And I find with some of these people that we're talking about, that the avoidant personality types are the ones who seek this out. There's this safety that comes from being someone who's up on the soapbox where everybody's looking up at me and I feel important and I can say inspirational things and I can get the energy that I need from people without the intimacy. And the anxious people in the crowd who are watching this feel like they're getting everything they need too from this avoidant person, which is why so often in intimate relationships, anxious and avoidant partners will find each other because they're a perfect match. You have the anxious person who's overdoing, you have the avoidant person who's pulling back, and like a rubber band kind of stretching them out, it'll always snap them back together. It's a weird phenomenon, but it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And I think this is what we're seeing. But your next level human, the one who's either had a secure attachment in their childhood and have worked to keep it that way, or the ones who have done things like shadow work or the inner work, spend time in therapy, working on neural pathway rewiring. Those are the people who are very secure where they can look at that and see it happening in real time and go, I don't like the energy of what's happening here. It doesn't feel authentic. It feels like something's just a little bit dissonant. Something's off. But the secure person is few and far between, because it's much easier to fall into one of the other categories and to have your life be something that's a little bit more of a, it's like a give and take that is never really matched.
Well, I love what you're getting into now. And so let's talk about that a little bit. So if I'm hearing you correctly and just feeding back that there is something that goes on in looking at the deep, sort of stories that we write in our unconscious mind, mm-hmm. and that can, if I'm hearing you correctly, can, if we begin to look at that and deal with it, even if we are more anxious and avoidant naturally, we can become more secure through this work. And so walk me through a little bit about how this works.
Yeah, and this is going to be deep into the science, but I'll kind of explain it as best I can in colloquial terms. Let's start with attachment. Our attachment is something that develops over time. So when we're children, from the moment that we're born, we're creating attachments with our primary attachment figure. Stereotypically, it's mom, because she tends to be the one, especially if there's breastfeeding involved, who's going to physically be there up all night with you because of breastfeeding, taking care of you during the day. But that can be something else. It can be the father, it can be grandparents, it could be adopted parents, it doesn't matter. We just need a primary attachment person. And how they respond to a child and what they do, like let's say mom has postpartum depression and doesn't jump up right away when the baby's crying and doesn't wake up overnight to feed them and just lets them deal with it, doesn't change their diapers, and maybe the other support people aren't there. What happens is that the child starts to develop this need for attention. But the fact that they're not getting it creates a barrier, where for survival purposes, they need to figure out how to self-soothe for themselves. This is how you get the avoidant type. The anxious type comes from the back and forth of like, sometimes parents are there, sometimes they're not. Sometimes I have my primary attachment figure, sometimes I don't. But the interesting thing about this is that we have different neurological phases that the brain goes through. So around the age of 5, when kids are going to kindergarten, there's a new phase. Now the primary attachment figure, while it was typically mom before, isn't any longer. It starts to move and move on to classmates and peers. And then eventually it moves on to a best friend, and then on to romantic partners, and then on to someone that you create a long-term partnership with. Those phases, each one individually, can rewrite your neural pathways and change the way that your brain sees the world. So you could have a really tumultuous relationship with your parents when you're young, and then have them turn a corner and heal themselves. And you go to school and develop really loving friendships. And then your first relationship is very healthy and you're secure in your attachment, even though you didn't start that way. So we can always change it. Here's where the science comes in, and this is what shadow work is at its core. It really is a process about rewiring the brain's neural pathways. So we start when we're babies, before we're even out of the womb, with a blank slate. The brain's neural tube is the first part of the development of the baby, and it literally is like a ball of clay. There's nothing to it. Eventually, that ball of clay will separate into brainstem, spinal cord, and the normal part of the brain that we think about with prefrontal cortex and all the different lobes like the temporal lobe, parietal lobe, occipital lobe. And when that happens, the brain doesn't have wiring yet, but every experience, whether the baby hears something really loud, like mom drops keys on the table and the baby jumps with a startle reflex, that creates a neural pathway. A neural pathway is like a highway in the brain. And every second of your life, from the second that neural pathways start to develop, you are either creating neural pathways or you're reinforcing current ones. It's always happening. By the time we get to about age 7, we start to be really reinforcing neural pathways that already exist instead of making new ones. Up until the age of 7, you're like a sponge, like always new neural pathways developing left and right and left and right. After 7, it slows. By the time you're about 25, it's rare to make new ones, unless you're someone who's really in the work and doing the things to break down old ones. But that's the trick, is you need to know how to break down old neural pathways, because we do something as humans called confirmation bias. We look for things that reinforce what we already believe. And this happens, I mean, you can see it with politics, right? People want to hear the people who are speaking about what they believe. So they listen to the people who are regurgitating the statements that they already feel in their bones. And then they go, see, I was right. And the reason why this happens is because those neural pathways are not really set in stone. They actually grow and develop. So if we think about a highway, it's like moving from a one-lane highway to a three-lane to a six-lane highway with thousands of exits off of it. They're always growing. And this is the reason why when we have a certain perspective on the world, it's hard to break it. You see, when we get into bad habits, how difficult it is to change it, or for an addict, how hard it is to give something up. And what we want to do with shadow work is we want to go back to the earliest moments when those neural pathways were first created the first time. And we want to break that down by altering how it's stored in the mind, body, and energy. Mm-hmm. So this is getting really deep, but the way that we do this is that there's something called the subconscious feedback loop. It is made up of your experiences, the chemical reactions in the brain, which are your emotions, the physiological reactions that occur because of that in the body, and then ultimately the thoughts that come up from the gut through the enteric nervous system. That's how we store memories. That's how we create memories in the first place. It's why when you walk outside and you can kind of smell someone's like wood fire burning in their fireplace, you might have a memory come up. Like you remember being at your grandparents' cabin up in upstate New York, and it just immediately, it's like you're right back there. Because the smell, that sensory experience, triggered the memory. So if we can go back and kind of re-trigger the memories of the first time something occurred for you, we can break it down. That's how we create new attachments. That's how we create new ways of thinking, new behaviors, and even new personalities, because your personality is not set in stone either.
It's time to talk about one of our sponsors of today's episode, AG1 by Athletic Greens. Now, many of you have heard me say this before, but I am not a fan of vegetables, which I know is funny given I've been in the health and fitness industry for so long. I blame my mother and father for this when I was a kid. What they would do is essentially take the broccoli, the Brussels sprouts, the spinach, the collard greens, and just steam them. No salt, no fat, no taste whatsoever, just these bitter greens. And so I developed a distaste for a lot of different vegetables, which has stayed with me into adulthood. One of the things I've done to mitigate that is use a greens powder pretty much ever since greens powders have come out on the market. And I've tried every single one. They started out tasting like swamp water. I found a few that I really like the taste, but recently, one that I have been taking for a very long time, as you all know, I wear a continuous glucose monitor. I found that it was actually spiking my blood sugar because probably the tapioca starch in it, which some people don't respond to tapioca starch with elevated blood sugars. I was. And so it sent me on a mission to find another one. And one of my friends turned me on to AG1 by Athletic Greens. And I've heard about Athletic Greens and AG1 for quite some time. I just never tried it. And now that I have tried it, I have become a huge fan, so much so that I partnered with Athletic Greens and AG1 to sponsor this podcast. Now, let me tell you what happened here. After I saw that my blood sugars were spiking, my friend gave me a couple samples of AG1. I began using those and testing the blood sugar and found there was no spike. The other thing I found is that AG1 is interested in its taste profile. It's very neutral. The one I was taking before was a little sweet. I really loved it. But this one is very neutral, which actually suits me because what I found is I can actually not only take this first thing in the morning in water and have it taste very neutral, almost like there's nothing there. I can also add it into my protein shakes, which means now I'm getting double the greens that I was getting previously because I add this right into my protein shakes and it does not change the flavor of the shake at all. The other thing I realized once I started looking at the label is that this product is not simply a greens product. It also is a multivitamin, multimineral. It also has fiber, which acts as a prebiotic. It has probiotics in it, and it has functional mushrooms, which act as adaptogens in it. That's four different products essentially in one. And I've been taking mushrooms for some time. I stopped taking them now because now I have this in my greens. I have also taken my multivitamin and make this my multivitamin. So I'm actually saving money, and this is going to save you money as well. The product AG1 is also NSF certified. And you're going to say, Jade, what does that mean? The National Sanitation Foundation is a foundation that essentially does testing on products to make sure there are no harmful substances, no persistent organic pollutants, no heavy metals. Now, this costs money to do. AG1 and Athletic Greens has spent the money on this. They spend money on making sure that the product that you are getting is good quality without contamination in it. You might say, well, Jade, isn't this true of all products? And actually, no, it is not. If you ever follow some of the news in this area through consumer labs and other things that do testing on these products, you'll see that many of them will have trace levels of things like mercury and cadmium and lead and things like that in them because they're not doing this testing. So this is an extra piece of insurance for us. The other thing I love about this product that I learned as I was doing my research on it is that this is the 52nd tweak or adjustment they have made to this product in their existence. AG1 has been tweaked 52 times. Now you might say, well, Jade, why would they be doing that? And the reason why is because they continue to improve. We know that science is evolving. We know that it's not just about more nutrients, it's about balanced nutrients. It's about the Goldilocks effect of this. And they are constantly learning, as we all are, and then constantly adjusting their product to taste better, to be more efficient and effective in delivering the nutrients. It acts as an antioxidant. It acts as a multivitamin. It's a prebiotic, a probiotic, and an adaptogen all in one. They have mastered this over several iterations of this particular product. And so I am a huge fan right now of AG1 and Athletic Greens, and I'm hoping that you will check this out. It's time for all of us to reclaim our health and arm our immune system with convenient daily nutrition. And AG1 does that with just one scoop in a cup of water every single day. That is all you need. There is now no longer a need for a million different pills and supplements to look after your health. All you need is this particular one. It really clears the stage to simplify your supplement regime. To make it easy for you, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/next level. That's athleticgreens.com/next level to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Check out AG1. I love it. I know you're going to love it. And I'm so happy that they are on board to sponsor the podcast as well. Thanks so much. Check out AG1, athleticgreens.com/next level. And let's get back to the show. Yeah, that's fascinating. So this memory that we form, do we write, you know, a way I like to think about it, and I'm asking you because perhaps it's the wrong way to think about it, but one of the ways I like to think about this, I like to think about something happens, we begin to sort of wire this sort of pathway. And the way I like to kind of think about it is like this long string of yarn, and let's say something traumatic happens and we tie a knot in the string of yarn, and it becomes almost like a, and again, this is a question. I know it's going to come across like a statement, but it becomes like a seed story in a sense. And this seed story, I call it a seed story because it grows all other stories. It shades our perception about the world. And so the first question is this an accurate way to think about this? And if so, and there is sort of a story, what we made this mean, can we work backwards as adults, find the stories we're telling ourselves about the world, and perhaps trace backward to those initial sort of triggering events where we wrote this story? Is this a reasonable way to look at it? Where am I getting this wrong? How can, you know, we work with this?
Well, I hope you're getting it right, because I literally wrote an entire book that you just broke down in 12 seconds. So you just explained shadow work. That's literally what my book is about, because those seed stories that you're talking about, or if people want to think about it another way, I like to reference movies because I feel like most people have seen them. It makes it easy. I've got kids. So Inside Out, they have those memories, those core memories that they talk about, and they influence all the ones that come beyond them. Same concept. And that's exactly what happens. Those core memories, or those seed stories that we're talking about, are the first neural pathway that gets laid down. And everything that comes beyond that is reinforcement of that neural pathway. It's essentially the widening of it, the deepening of it, the ability to create connected neural pathways and have a neuronal network that emerges from the initial pathway. So you're spot on.
Yeah. And this, thank you for that. That makes me feel a little bit better in the way that I see it, that the expert, you know, sort of has described it the same way. And if this is the case, then, so I can imagine someone listening to you and I talk, and they, you know, they kind of know that perhaps they have, you know, some issues. And by the way, here's another thing that maybe you can confirm or deny in terms of your, one of the things that I've seen in my work is that there seems to be, the subconscious mind seems not to speak a language of logic and written words, so to speak, but it seems to speak a language of emotion, patterns, recurrent obstacles. And so I oftentimes will see people having these repeated patterns, these stuck emotions, these recurrent obstacles, these, you know, challenges that recur again and again. It almost is like life is saying, hey, here are all the patterns that you are seeing based on your perception of the world. It's not working for you. You need to go back and look at how you're seeing the world, which then has this maybe seed story as the triggering event. I can imagine someone listening to this, if this is really how it works, and goes, well, how the hell now as an adult do I begin to rewire this, you know, sort of thought process? And so I imagine it's can be daunting for someone to hear this. So is it simply about, you know, finding these repeated patterns, or catching these stories that are related to this seed story, and then reprogramming it in some way, you know, using written exposure therapy, maybe meditation, maybe, you know, psychedelics? Like, what are the things that you feel like are the big, you know, pieces, or the sort of stepwise process you use in your work?
Yeah, I think a lot of people can hear something like this and feel overwhelmed, because the idea that we're talking about, say, 30, 40, 50 years of doing things one way and having to find the core reason why that's the way things have moved forward, that feels like a monumental task, but it's actually easier than we give it credit for. The subconscious, all those automatic things, the behaviors, the thoughts, those are all vehicles for the unconscious mind. So if we examine the subconscious and we look at the things that you do every single day, the recurrent thoughts that you have, one way to do this work is to start there and to look backwards and go, what's the root cause? How far back can I go? And that's where things like shadow work journals tend to be very popular, especially on places like TikTok, where people are always posting shadow work journal prompts. I personally, after all the years of doing the work that I do, and experiencing other modalities and seeing how much better shadow work works than things like therapy, even though I'm a licensed therapist, find that there are better ways. There's more optimal ways to get there. Things like you mentioned. So things like meditation, things like psychedelics, and things like traditional shadow work. And shadow work's funny because people have a specific definition of it in their minds of what it is because they hear a bunch of people talk about it. So what I hear people say is shadow work is just the process of looking at the unhealed parts of yourself, which isn't incorrect, but it's not fully correct either. Carl Jung, who created this back in the 1800s, used meditation. And what he would do is he would help people meditate to the point where they could actually access memories that they have forgotten about. The brain's fascinating. Everything you have ever experienced, every license plate you've ever seen is stored in your head. But if I ask you to tell me the last license plate that you saw, there's no way you'll remember it unless it was your own and you already memorized it. But it's there. We can actually pull it back up. And we can do this through meditation. Because what happens with meditation is when we meditate to the point that we're in something called theta brainwave state, the door to the unconscious mind is wide open. The reason why it's typically closed is because if you were to remember everything that's ever happened to you, the brain wouldn't be able to prioritize what it needs. You'd be inundated with information. It'd be like having a computer and not having any folders on the desktop. Just every single thing on the computer is just on the desktop and you have to figure out where things are and how to find them. So the unconscious is there for a reason. It's meant to keep back the information that you don't need access to right now. But that information is still completely altering the way you're programmed. It's the neural pathways. It's how you see the world. So with meditation, what you can do is set the intention to see something specific. So let's say someone is having a lot of issues in their business and they're having trouble. I see this all the time with the people that I work with through private mentorship or even through the shadow work that I do, where they feel like they are not going to succeed and they actually self-sabotage. And I watch it happen where they're supposed to be posting every single day. You have to share your offers. They come off as inauthentic. And we go, why is it that this is happening? Because when you and I talk, it's all good. It's perfect. It sounds great. But then you get out there in a camera and you're not you anymore. It's like you're shutting it down. So you set the intention prior to the meditation, telling your brain essentially where you want it to go. And you just ask, can I see the first time? It honestly is that simple. And when you meditate in that theta brainwave state, you'll be transported back to the moment when you were 3 years old and you watched your dad fail in business and he came home and he was crying. You've never seen your dad cry at any point in your life other than that. And it just hits you. It's like a knot in your chest and you feel it, that fight or flight mode that kicks in. So that moment, that teeny moment, we're talking about maybe 5 minutes of your time, change the entire directory of your life. And now in the moments where you could potentially be on the verge of succeeding, you shut yourself down because you don't ever want to be like that. You don't want to have the moment that your dad had happen to you. So it's simple. It's really easy. I think people like doing things like psychedelics, which I'm all for. Ayahuasca is great. Psilocybin, they're wonderful under proper care with someone who is trained and certified to do that work, or a shaman who's been doing this throughout generations, trained by the elders in their society. Otherwise, please don't do it because it's like knocking that door to the unconscious mind wide open. Because when you're under the influence, you're in theta brainwave state in such a way that you're not picking out one moment, you're having them all flood through. So people who do things like ayahuasca ceremonies will remember every traumatic thing that has happened to them throughout their lives. And afterwards, they have to pick up the pieces of finding out that they were molested by an uncle, finding out that their parents considered divorce and like had that conversation in front of them when they were two, that they fell and broke their front two teeth at a playground when they were 6 months old, when they had like just gotten their teeth. Like those moments all coming back at once, it's too intense for us to hold on to. And physiologically, we have a big response when that happens. That's why I like shadow work. You're really regulating the body and the emotions at the same time so that as we bring this stuff up, we can heal it in a way that makes you feel not overwhelmed, very present, your body and aligned.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting to hear you say that about psychedelics because one of the things I've noticed with many people who do psychedelics and many people on this podcast know some of my experiences, but many of my friends are like, when are you doing it again? When are you doing it again? And part of me just goes, I haven't fully unpacked, integrated, dealt with the last experience. And it seems to me that there can be, like with many things, and again, no judgment, we humans are humans, and so it's kind of what we do. But one of the things I've seen with the psychedelic work, it's incredibly powerful, but I see people just going back and back and back and back instead of integrating the work. It's kind of like one of these people that, you know, you see wants to read, you know, a book every single week, but doesn't intellectually ever own the book because they're just trying to get through it so fast. To me, that's what it's like or can be like with psychedelics oftentimes. One of the things I want to ask you about, because it's one of my favorites, and I just want to see what the expert says about this, is I have really taken to writing. I am an author, you know, so people know that I write an awful lot of books. And one of the things that I found is through my writing, I was able to have literally felt like out of body experiences, tapping into some of the memories of, you know, my childhood, and literally writing a passage and beginning to process emotions to the point where when it first started happening to me, I didn't quite understand what was going on. But now I love it when I'm in a deep passage or writing about my mother in particular and some of my mother wounds, that this stuff will come up for me. And so I've integrated very heavily things like written exposure therapy and other techniques in this regard. Can you speak to that at all? How is that actually working? And is that something that you use? And is there a mechanism that helps explain why this can be powerful if it is?
Yes, it is powerful. And I think the mechanism there from all the research that I've seen is theta brainwave state. That when you get into that trance-like state, and not everybody does this, which is why some people will not relate to this feeling. But if you can get yourself into that meditative state where it's like the pen is moving and your mind is kind of coming second, where your hand is moving first, and then you're going, oh my gosh, I can't believe I put that down on paper. That's when the unconscious is open and the information is just putting itself right before you. So that is shadow work. It's another way to do it. And it's a really powerful one. For me, everybody's different, right? There's visual learning. There's people who really learn from auditory experiences. Probably a lot of the people listening to this podcast would fall under that because that's why they're here. And there are people who learn from actually writing things down. And the way that you learn will dictate how best to do this type of work. For some people, it's things like sound healing. Sound healing experiences are another example of this, where if we put on binaural beats, it forces the brain into theta, and all of a sudden the memories just show back up. So it's the same thing, different pathways with the exact same result, but they're altered and tweaked by the way that you learn best.
I love that, Danielle. So it sounds like what you're saying is if I'm someone who's more visual, then perhaps guided meditation, visual type of things where we're trying to elicit a sort of visual memory in the body. If I'm someone who's more auditory, then perhaps sound baths and that kind of thing. And if you're somebody, maybe insight-based stuff, listening to, you know, books and things like that. And if you're someone like me, perhaps, that writes a lot, and I do think actually I'm more visual, so I do very well with visualizations, but it's really interesting. I don't know what happened somewhere along the way as I started to write more. I think I developed the ability to tap into this state as well. Let's talk a little bit about this because you alluded to, and I bet you people are interested. So this theta brain state that you're alluding to, can you educate us on this a little bit? What exactly is this? What are some of the things that can get us there? And what is actually happening? And then I want to ask you, I want to get into a little bit about just the what your thoughts are on consciousness, because I have some as well. And you seem like it might be fun to have that conversation. But talk to us a little bit about theta, the theta brain state.
Yeah. So theta is just a brainwave pattern. So if we think about it in terms of like an electrical wave, there is a random state that we are in normally every day. And like when we're talking to other people, when we're listening, the wave itself is a little bit tighter. So we're going to have short wave patterns and they're going to move pretty close together and they're going to be at even levels. That's when the brain is active and it's engaged and it's ready to take information in. When we're sleeping, the brainwave pattern really spreads itself out and there's big highs and big lows in that wave. It's kind of like you took the little skinny one, you pulled it all the way out, and then you slowly moved it back together. Theta is actually somewhere in between, leaning towards the latter, where the spacing is kind of like moved out, It's a slow pattern, but at the same time, you are conscious enough to get up and walk away. You could take a phone call. You're not asleep, essentially. So how to know that you're in theta is when you feel like your entire body is relaxed, kind of like that feeling of melting down. So your heart rate is really slow. Your breathing has slowed down in such a way that you feel like your shoulders are all the way down. There's no tension anywhere in your body. And this is an interesting one, but important for me as someone who facilitates shadow work. Around your eyes, when you are really activated, we tend to just crunch them in a little bit. And what I look for to see that people are in theta is I want to see that all melt away. So any fine lines, anything that's going on in there around this area, for the people who are listening to this, around the third eye, in between your brow bones, around the corners of your eyes, and even towards the center corners of your eyes, I want to see them all relax in such a way that it's like there's no tension in your face anymore. That's how I know that we're good. We're in that space. And when you're there, it's like your whole body has switched modes. And when we think about it in terms of autonomic nervous system, it's like you've moved from fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, which is really just your body's way of producing adrenaline and cortisol, into a space of rest and digest, where those chemicals are not being produced anymore. And when we're there, that's when we can heal. The funny thing about this, the interesting thing, is from an evolutionary perspective, human beings used to spend the vast majority of our time in rest and digest. And we would only switch into fight, flight, freeze, or fawn when there was an active threat, like a bear charging the group. Nowadays, especially in America, we spend 96% of our time in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. That's insane. That means that the body doesn't have time to restore, to regenerate, or to relax. It's why most Americans have trouble sleeping and why we have so much disease and illness. Our body literally does not have the resources to be able to heal itself. I think that's why I developed cancer. That's my hypothesis.
Yeah. So. It's time for one of our sponsors, and this sponsor is a very exciting one and a new one, Timeline Nutrition and their supplement, MitoPure. Now, if I was going to ask you what is the most important aspect of metabolism, the mitochondria would have to be tops on your list. The mitochondria are the little energy producing factories inside every single one of your cells. They take the end products of the food we eat, they break them down into cellular ATP and provide energy for the entire metabolism. And these mitochondria, if they are healthy and acting appropriately, can keep us looking good, feeling good, living longer, and functioning better. However, when they are not at optimal function, when they are burning energy in a dirty fashion, when they are damaged, they actually speed cellular aging. They speed up the aging process. We end up suffering from things like fatigue. We end up having all manner of dysfunctions, including weight loss resistance and other issues around weight loss. The mitochondria are the most important elements for the metabolism to function optimally, lose weight, age appropriately, etc. In this compound, MitoPure, that Timeline Nutrition has developed, there is a product called Urolithin A. Now, Urolithin A is an interesting compound because it is a postbiotic. Now, what does that mean? A postbiotic is a compound that is made from the bacteria in the gut. And so when you eat things like pomegranates, strawberries, walnuts, things with polyphenols like this, they go into the digestive tract, your gut bacteria start working on them, and they can create compounds. Urolithin A is one compound that is in the MitoPure product. It comes from, naturally occurs in nature from this bacteria in our gut that break down the polyphenols from primarily foods like pomegranates, strawberries, etc. And it can increase mitophagy in mitochondria. So you might say, well, Jade, what is mitophagy? Mitophagy is the ability for mitochondria to repair and regenerate and recycle their proteins and to stay healthy and functional and de-age. When we can stimulate mitophagy, we can keep our mitochondria functioning efficiently. We can decrease aging. We can increase energy. We can improve our ability to lose weight, function optimally, and stave off diseases of aging. This is what Timeline Nutrition has done with their MitoPure product, and the urolithin A that is in it. This is a very exciting area of research. We have not had the ability to support the mitochondria in the way that we do now with this particular product. You definitely are going to want to check this out. I've been taking the product for several months now. It is one of these products that I really, really strongly recommend. To get the product MitoPure, all you have to do is go to timelinenutrition.com/next level. timelinenutrition.com/next level. And let's get back to the show. I would agree with that hypothesis, and it is something that I want to study. Actually, this goes into why transpersonal psychology for me. My hypothesis is there's something around when we humans regulate to the environment, our consciousness sort of merges, in a sense, my hypothesis, with the surrounding environment, and that can help us get into these slower wave states. And one of the things that, you know, and you can, you know, sort of correct me if I'm wrong here, but for the listener, one of the things that I oftentimes tell people about theta state is I feel, and I love when this happens, it's that time when I am, you know, so relaxed, I've just been sleeping, and I come out of a deep sleep, and I'm deeply conscious at the same time, yet my body still feels like it's asleep. And in that state, I oftentimes ask my subconscious questions, and the answers to these questions never come logically or through written word. They come in symbols, they come in metaphors, they come in these sort of weird ways that we can decipher. And of course, you mentioned Carl Jung. This was a big part of his work, even looking at the idea that perhaps even in dream states, we can begin tapping into this a little bit. And this is the next part of what I want to talk about, which gets to some controversial aspects of things. But I know from doing a little study about you that you're deeply into spirituality. We sort of both are in that regard. And from my perspective, when we look at our ego conscious and then what's beneath that, the subconscious, what I am very much interested in and want to understand how you see this and if you're using this in shadow work is that to me, it's all just consciousness, and beneath that is sort of bubbling up from sort of collective consciousness, universal consciousness, or what I might call source consciousness. And that this source consciousness is sort of where we all begin to have access to the same pool of knowledge, the same consciousness. This would be where me and Danielle could tap into each other. Me and all the listeners and Danielle, we begin to be able to tap into something deeper, the place that we all sort of connect. And what I'm interested in, and this is going to get, you know, somewhat woo-woo, but I want to see what you think on this. Part of me, and just so everyone knows and Danielle knows, you know, my belief system, and whatever your belief systems are, is fine. But my belief system is not very God-oriented, actually. And it's fine if someone else's is, but I'm relatively agnostic in this. However, I do feel that there's something there that is a creative energetic driving potential. I just call it source consciousness. If someone calls it God, cool. But there's something about that for me that I feel like is giving us the opportunity to learn particular lessons, have particular experiences. And I've oftentimes wondered that the individuals who've gone through some of the deepest traumas, when they turn those traumas into something that becomes their purpose, which certainly we hear a little bit about your story, Danielle, and this is certainly part of what happened for you. You made a very big switch as you started going through your suffering, that something magical happens in that, that it's this idea that many people on the podcast have heard me say that pain can be a path to purpose. Suffering can be a source of meaning. You're hurt can be a way for you to help. And I'm wondering, my hypothesis is that there's something beneath this that is forcing us to evolve ourselves so that we can enrich the world, so that perhaps we can evolve this source consciousness in a sense. So that's a very woo-woo type question for a lot of people. But I just want to hear from you if you see anything or have any opinions about this or any hypothesis yourself about this perhaps deeper level that goes beyond ego consciousness, subconscious, and gets to this sort of source consciousness, and what role it might play if any, in shadow work?
Yeah. So I'll say this before we start. It's funny because I started my career so science-based and really needing the facts and the information and the proof to get things to get to a place, right? And now I'm in a place where I've seen some crazy things, things that I have trouble articulating because they're so magnificent and not really something we have words for here. So it's hard sometimes to talk about these concepts because it's amazing. But I want to talk about one. And with shadow work, there's an aspect of it where we're really tapping into repressed memories, things that are buried within the unconscious mind. And for me, I think about it as four stages. We have that ego, consciousness, subconscious, unconscious, which is more personal. It's really like our memories that have been repressed. And then source consciousness that we tap into all the time. And that helps guide me through shadow work. Because when I do shadow work, someone, I'm tapping into your consciousness. I see what you see. It's like I'm standing there with you as we go through it. So one of the things that I've seen over the years of doing this is that a lot of the repressed memories that we hold onto are things from ancestors and things from past lives, other times that we've incarnated here. And that's something that I'm going to make another book about when the time comes, book number two that I'll have coming out. But with past lives, something that I've done and seen, and I've looked into the research from people like Dr. Brian Weiss and Dr. Michael Newton, some of the bigger names who are doing this work and doing the research, putting people in MRI scanners as they do, is that we have this ability in between lives to take time to learn from the things that we've done and to decide what happens the next time we show up. And for the people who are listening to this, who are like, wow, this is really weird and out of left field, I want to tell you about a couple different cases that I've had. The clients that I work with don't know each other. I have people in Norway, people in Alaska, people in Hawaii, people in Ohio, and they've never met each other before. They don't really know this aspect of what I do. This is the first time I've even ever talking about this on a podcast. But I'll regress them back into the moment where they're in that theta brainwave state. I'll nudge them in. They'll see a moment from their past life. And then what I'll do is I'll ask them to go back even further to the time before or to fast forward to the time in between that one and this one. And when they get to that space, they all talk about it exactly the same. They talk about how they know who the souls that they're interacting with are, but they look like wispy smoke, like gray smoke. They talk about having lessons that they had to learn and not having any emotions about it. Like they can look at an experience like I had, like cancer, and it doesn't feel like it belongs to them. There's no emotion attached to it. It's just information. And then they also have the same ideas around choosing what they're going to do next, where there are other wispy souls that they're interacting with, and they're having discussions about the level of trauma that they're going to incur. Like in this next iteration of life, I could drop down into that meat suit. And when I do, I might lose a limb. And I was someone who was training for the Olympics. And then that'll change my entire trajectory for life. And what I do from there can go down one of six different paths. It can either lead to like a horrific outcome where I'm homeless, living on the streets and addicted to drugs, or it could lead to me in the White House at the end of it. So essentially, we are choosing so many of these things ahead of time. If I heard this once, I wouldn't believe it. But the fact that I've worked with literally hundreds of people, probably closer to 1,000 at this point, who all are talking about it the same way. Same thing with like near-death experiences. The discussions around them, the things that people report are all the same. How are we all having the same image? Maybe it is collective unconscious. Maybe it is something else we don't know. And there's so much that we don't know. We have no clue. The information that we have right now is already outdated. But what I do know from what I've experienced is that there's something more that we don't really understand quite yet. And maybe we're not meant to. Maybe it's something that's really meant to just lead us. But I do agree. I think that our traumas really change our trajectory and they kind of knock us onto a different path on purpose. And I think personally, from what I've seen, that you could get to that path without a trauma. You don't need to have something monumental like a cancer diagnosis that knocks you over. I think it's like a course correction where if you weren't following your path in the first place, you have that bump over that gets you there. But it doesn't have to be that way because you can create peace and prosperity and abundance from a place of calm just as easily.
Yeah, Danielle, you and I are very, very similar because I also, although I did choose holistic medicine early on, which was a really scary choice way back in the day, I had no idea it was going to become a thing at the time. This would be in the late 90s. I am a very science-based guy. I just want to share with you and the listeners really quickly, in my last psychedelic experience, which I haven't talked about on the podcast yet. I have talked about my ayahuasca experience. I had an LSD sort of journey with someone, and I always do these in sort of a ceremonial fashion. And I had what people would call a past life regression. And being a scientific-minded guy, I'm a little bit like you, and I could tell the way that you are, we're very similar, that you'll just come out and say it. And then you also back up and say, well, I don't know exactly what this is. So I don't actually know if it was a past life experience or if I was tapping into someone else's past life or if it was just a allegorical, metaphorical lesson for me. But I will say this, I had a felt experience of what it meant for my life and the ramifications of the patterns that I was living in this life versus what happened in that past life. And so whatever it is we call this, whether it's an actual past life, whether it's we're tapping into an energetic signature of someone else's past life, or whether or not this is just our intelligent sort of source conscious, unconscious, sort of talking to us and trying to make sense of the world and speaking to us in metaphorical language, to me, there's something deeply profound going on. And I would echo what you say, that we simply don't know what this is. But I do want to present a hypothesis here and see what you think. Are you familiar with the differences between materialism as a philosophy and idealism as a philosophy? Do you know the two orientations there?
I do.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just catch the listener up, and I know we're running up on time, so maybe this will be where you and I will end. But the best way I can explain it is materialism is this idea, both you and I being science-minded people, you being, someone who studied cognitive neuroscience, the idea is, this idea of the problem of consciousness. We, the belief of materialism would say, look, the brain is just this complex mix of neurochemicals and this web of neurology that then, spontaneously creates consciousness. This would be materialism, matter creating consciousness. Now, the other way to look at that is that we are simply, everything is consciousness. And we humans are sort of like fish made of water, swimming in water in a sense. And, that old thing of like where the old fish swims by the two young fish and says, how's the water, boys? And they go, what the hell is water? We don't necessarily realize that it's all just mind, all consciousness. This would be more the idea of the idealist philosophy, and that our brain is more like a filter for consciousness. So maybe Danielle is, 107 FM and Jade is 105 FM and you listeners like 102 FM. And we're downloading particular frequencies here. Where do you, as sort of someone who's been traditionally scientifically trained and now someone who's doing this work, do you think that we are moving more towards this idealism way of looking at consciousness versus materialism? And where do you sort of see how that might explain some of these things that you and I have seen and experienced in our work, but science has no explanation for as of yet?
Yeah. And science is catching up. That's the interesting thing. Like there have been some recent papers that have come out from the field of string theory that back up the idealistic view that we are just consciousness made matter. And we're not even really matter, to be honest, because each one of us, our molecules, our atoms, they all break down into air. We're essentially like air bubbles taking up space, and there's nothing to us. Each one of the electrons and protons that are involved in our system can be broken apart. So when you think about it, if we were to look with the deepest level microscope that doesn't exist yet, there's nothing to us. We're not here. We're experiencing. We're just space. That's all that we are. And it's interesting now because these papers that have come out about it from string theory are extremely recent. This is brand new information. The studies have not been replicated yet. So this is really new information. But I think this is the direction that we're headed. Really looking into the fact that we are just consciousness. And if that's the case, because we have to say if, right? Like from a science background, you can never say anything definitively. We have to say if that's the case. Then what does that mean? What are the implications of us being consciousness? And how do these physical bodies play into it? And if that's the case, why do some people's physical bodies have issues like mine did, things like a cancer diagnosis? What is going wrong within this air bubble, pockets of air bubbles, that's creating this energetic discourse that leads to sickness that's not happening for other people? So this is fascinating to me and something that I like to read about in my spare time. And you mentioned earlier, as someone who likes to read, you really like to integrate. I'm the same way. People think because I'm an author that I'm reading like 10 books at a time. Never. I'm reading one book at a time. I'm probably reading the same chapter 3 or 4 times because I need to process it. I need to sit with it. I need to think about it. And I don't think we really absorb all the information until we get to read it multiple times. And so I've done that with some of these articles and really started to look at this idea. And it's going to change everything. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're really going to see a shift in how people across the board talk about us and our humanity.
Yeah, you know, Danielle, I'm really excited that you and I got a chance to know each other because I didn't realize that we are so in alignment. And sometimes this is really nice because it just reinforces that we're really reading and studying and thinking along the same lines. And funnily enough, I had never called any of this work a shadow work, but I will certainly start to, sort of do that now under your sort of education and expertise. I really want to thank you for your time. The book, just so everyone knows, is Shadow Work. My girlfriend is presently reading it and absolutely loving it. So make sure you check out Danielle's book. And Danielle, where can they find you? Are you one of these people that spends time online? Are you educating in those places, website, all that stuff?
Yep, I'm everywhere online at I am Danielle Massey. And you can buy my book anywhere books are sold. Go to your local Barnes & Noble. It'll be there, Target, Walmart, or your local crystal shop because they love to carry that there too. And I'm always open to answering questions. I know that some of the things that we talked about today are heavy and they're also stuff that can be really confusing. So feel free to reach out to me. It's me in my DMs always.
I am Daniel Massey on all the social medias. I will follow you too, Danielle. I don't follow you yet, but this has just been fascinating. And thank you so much, my friend. Do me a favor, hang on the line. I just want to make sure this thing loads up and as I stop the recording. But anyway, everyone else, thanks so much for hanging out with me and Danielle, and we will see you next time.
You have been listening to the Next Level Human podcast with Dr. Jade Tita. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure you subscribe and consider leaving a review. You make the biggest difference when you pass on your lessons and inspire others. That's why reviews like this are so powerful. Your words may be the only ones that resonate for someone else. Please remember the information in this podcast is for educational purposes only. Always consult your personal physician or therapist before making any lifestyle changes. And finally, thank you for who you are in the world and the difference you make.